Live from the heart of the universe, this is the online edition of the Life Changes Show.
Look at the bright lights. Look at the bright
lights. With tonight's guests, we'll founders of Impossible Creative, David Galpern and Charles Roy.
Night sky. Look at the night sky.
And performance guest, Evan Oberla. I am Mark Leisure, and now our host, the MC, the master of change, Filippo Voltaggio.
The power of story lies in its ability to connect people, convey values, and inspire action. So says commonslibrary.org. I came across a story that illustrates the power of story on an Instagram story by a person that goes by Istok Pavlovich. And I shared it with a friend, I don't know, maybe a week or so ago. Well, she shared it back just this morning, or at least I saw it this morning that she shared it back. And so she wrote, I love this. Thank you for sending, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm like, well, she loved it. I loved it. What was it? And I went back and I'm like, oh, yeah, that's perfect for today's show. Thank you so much. So in the Instagram post, this guy was talking about the now very, very famous, and we all know him, Vincent van Gogh artist, who nobody knew at the time when he lived, and even soon after he lived. While he was alive, evidently he couldn't sell any of his paintings, and he ended up dying very poor. Ironically, his brother was an art dealer who lived in Paris, who was sending him money, evidently, to survive so that he could also keep on painting. But his brother couldn't sell any of his paintings either. So Vincent died, and then 6 months later, his brother died. And so Vincent's brother's wife, Johanna, was left with literally hundreds of paintings because supposedly Vincent was sending his brother almost a painting a day. He was so prolific in painting. And the story goes that Johanna tried to sell the paintings on her own. She gave it a go herself by opening up gallery exhibitions, and for months and months, nothing happened. And then one day she thought about the fact that her brother had sent her brother-in-law, Vincent van Gogh, had sent her husband letters, his brother, almost every day with the paintings, talking about his purportedly miserable life as a painter and how tough it was, etc. And he would write about the paintings in the letters. So she thought about this evidently and wrote a book where she compiled all the letters, and it was called Vincent van Gogh, A Life in Letters. And the book became an overnight sensation. People were interested in reading about the wild, chaotic life of the artist who they didn't know, named Vincent van Gogh. Now, at the time, when they would see paintings of his bedroom or a flower or a crazy starry night that didn't even look like a starry night to them in those days in the 1800s in Paris, when art looked very different, they just saw these random paintings probably and didn't think anything of them. Nobody bought them, and they were valueless. But once the stories got out there, then people were interested in the paintings, and evidently the value of the paintings exploded almost overnight. And so all of a sudden, a bedroom wasn't just a bedroom anymore. The bed was actually, as the letter shares, the very first bed and the very first thing that Vincent van Gogh could afford to buy himself. And so became that much more meaningful. When attaching the story to a painting, the interest in the price went up. And by the way, if it was zero before, it's now, supposedly the whole collection is now worth over $10 billion. So it illustrates the power of a story. and the fact, especially when emotion is attached to it. So back to commonslibrary.org, the role of emotion in storytelling. Emotions play such a crucial role. They help convey the significance of the narrative and can drive people to take action. I believe tonight we have all the elements here for great story and lots of great action.
Great story and a focus on experience. When you were talking about adding the story, it made me think of, you know, we can tell a story about having gone to wherever, Yosemite, and then came home. Or you can tell a story about going to Yosemite, being chased by mountain lions and getting lost in a cave and whatever the experience is that's being shared, the depth of it, the thread, exactly what you're saying.
Relate to it.
Right.
Or relate to their own experiences.
And have their own experience, right? Exactly. Have an extension, like feel what the feeling might have been. And these guys, our guests tonight, have been leading the way in this for such a long time. And I'm so excited to be able to allow them to share their story and visions as they really pioneered a lot of participatory theater and started breaking the fourth wall a long time ago. And looking at the way storytelling layers into all aspects of information exchange, whether it's art or theater or filmic storytelling.
You know, Mark, I've gotten to listen to you talk about immersive and experiential and participatory, but participatory isn't used a lot yet. So
no, and it's an important shift, and that's part of what I think is the highlight of tonight's conversation. The underlying consciousness change that we're living through is a movement from the way we were entertained, passive consumption, sit there, watch somebody else's experience, to being more involved, to participating more. You know, kids don't want to buy things. They want to drive across the country and go to a festival. You know, it's participatory. And the same way with storytelling is going to become, especially as technology is evolving and immersive spaces are going to become much more participatory and therefore experiential.
Storytelling is the heart of the participatory economy. This is episode 870 of the Life Changes Show, and we are delighted to feature interview guests, producer, founder, and creative strategist of Impossible Creative, David Galpern, and producer, stage director, writer, tech entrepreneur, and studio executive of Impossible Creative, Charles Roy. Welcome, David and Charles, to the Life Changes Show.
Hey, Filippo.
It's great to have you both here, especially after having heard so much about you all and unfortunately not having gotten the experience of experiencing your work in person yet. I've seen lots of stuff, but in person, and that's really at the heart of so much of what we're talking about. But this journey started a long time ago for the two of you. When would you say it started? Was it even... Let me ask you this, before the two of you met.
Well, that's an interesting point, because David and I have been friends since college days. And in fact, we were even sophomore roommates in Montreal doing shows together at the McGill University, mostly in the interest of chasing whatever girl we happened to have crushes on at the time.
Yeah, and it's interesting.
Well, that answers my second question.
Well, you know, and it's interesting because Charles and I met because we were both pre-med students. So we like to say that our parents both think that we are still pre-med all these years later.
One day we'll get there. One day we'll get to medical school, Dave.
but you know, both of us, even though we were studying to become doctors, we both came from high schools where we had spent a lot of time doing theater and performance and fascinated by film and art. And so it was certainly something that I think was very strong in both of us before we even met each other.
Uh-huh. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think we share that common core of seeing something cool in front of us and wanting to be in it, wanting to sort of roll around in it and see how it works and, you know, get out of the audience and on the stage was something that I think drove both of us early on.
So early on, the very first thing you all did, you literally engaged the audience in a really dramatic way. And so I'd love for you to share what that is, because I don't even know if anybody's really even doing it now. But back when, tell us what you did and what you think you were doing when you did that. Like, what'd you think this was supposed to, was it to impress girls? I don't know. Tell us.
One of the first show that Charles and I ever actually created, produced together, this would have been in the late 90s in Montreal. And this was before 9/11, so you could still do this kind of thing. But we did a show where when the audience arrived, we took everybody hostage. So one by one, they would walk through a door, they'd get a bag put over their head, and they would literally be carried off their feet down a set of stairs, forced into a chair, yelled at by the hostage takers.
Wow.
And after about, 10 minutes of sitting in isolation, they would have their bags removed from their head. And this play about three people who had been taken hostage in Lebanon would begin. And
Wow.
it was this profound experience because, both Charles directed it, I performed in it, and we really saw the audience react in a profound, visceral way. And it was so amazing to us because every night, the word got out, and we were 19 at the time, and somehow we had this hit on our hands, and people were coming night after night, and word was getting out, and the lines were growing.
Yeah, it was a really moving experience. What it was born from really just the circumstances in which we were mounting the play. We couldn't find a theater in which to do it, so we rented the unfinished basement of a coffee shop. And it was kind of this dungeon-like place, which was very fitting for the play and the characters who were living this story. And we realized that the audience was going to be right there with them, and so we leaned into that, and we brought them in, as David expressed, giving them a taste of what being kidnapped or being a hostage would feel like, or what that emotional experience would be. And then when all of a sudden the hoods were removed, they were not sitting in the dark watching actors tell a story in the light. They were in it with them, and all of a sudden something changed, and a switch flipped for both David and me. We realized just how intense the immersive experience could actually be. And this was before there was even a word for immersive. We didn't know what we were doing. This was pure instinct at the time.
Wow. Well, when I said I haven't had the pleasure of experiencing your work, that wasn't the one I was talking about. But I mean, all the later ones. How did the later ones start to develop? Did you say, "Oh, this really works. Let's try something else like that," or was it piece by piece?
Yeah, well, after we finished our undergraduate degrees, we started a theater company called the Classical Theater Project, which began with a very sort of small, what we thought was going to be a small mission, which was performing works of classic plays for teens, for high school students. And we sort of grew the company over the years, and we continued to incorporate immersive elements in there. And so audiences in, say, Romeo and Juliet, audiences would be dancing with the actors in the famous ball scene, or if it was the Scottish play, then they were, kids in the audience would be standing up and yelling battle cries to storm, the castles at the end. So as much as we possibly could, and the actors would flow in and out of the audience. And so we didn't so much break the fourth wall as we just denied its existence from the beginning. And again, we felt an extraordinary immediacy with the plays, with the audiences, with the stories, and then we saw this extraordinary transformation happen in front of us every single day for years and years and years. We ran that company for almost 20 years.
Speaking of,
I'm
were you gonna,
sorry.
yeah, go ahead,
I was
please.
going to say, what happened was we were doing this and we were growing it and we grew it to the point that we were playing to 1 million kids across 90 cities across North America. And it was really starting to, become this thing which was difficult to keep growing. The more we were out on the road touring these shows, the more weeks a year we were, in Memphis one day and Kearney, Nebraska the next. We had to figure out how to keep this thing going and growing, and we realized, we had this conversation between us that actually started from the place of education and breaking that fourth wall to how could we take what we were doing and scale it properly? Because the more we toured, the more it cost, the more we were out on the road, the more we were away. And even though we were having a huge impact and we were playing, you know, to bigger and larger audiences, it just, you know, it was really grueling. And in the late 2000s, I was speaking of Nebraska. I was actually in Omaha, and I had a couple of days off, and I went to the Henry Dorley Zoo just across the border in Iowa. And I saw this remarkable thing where, you know, this was in the early days of video conferencing. There was a zookeeper doing an event inside the penguin exhibit. And she had a group of kids from equatorial regions watching her feed these penguins. And these were kids who had never seen ice before, let alone a penguin. And I remember coming back to Charles and saying, you know, what if we could do that with the way we create? Is there a way we could find a way to actually scale this and cross that digital physical boundary to bring people to places they had literally never been before? And this was this became, you know, a conversation that both of us had been having in our own ways. And it started really fomenting our next phase of work as we moved away from purely in the stage and into experimenting with what it meant to do things that were both digital and theatrical.
Yeah, absolutely. And it sort of it moved us into really exploring tech as well. You know, initially we were using tech just to solve storytelling moments in our live stage work, you know, holograms or this, that, the other. And then we realized that by leaning into some of the tech that we were developing just in-house, it could actually really push some of these ideas forward. And skip ahead 10 years, and we're now in a place where we can create fully simulated environments within projection or LED rooms that, as Dave was saying, they cross that digital analog divide, and all of a sudden the real and the digital suddenly blur together, and you can no longer really tell if you're in a simulated space or a real space. And the storytelling possibilities therein are beginning to blow our mind. We're right at the very beginning of it, of just figuring out how to do effective storytelling within that environment. But so far, the few shows that we have done have been unbelievable.
You know, talk about breaking the fourth wall. It seems so beyond that, because you all talk about the six walls. So for those people who don't know what the six walls are, could you briefly share that?
Sure. So the concept is one that we've called the Wonder Room. And so, as you said, at its basic, it's six walls. So four walls, a floor and a ceiling that are all connected and all covered in LED tiles. So you can create a single VR style image, like VR, but without the goggles, in a physical room. And it's all the software behind it and all of that. And from there, your imagination can really take wing. From there, the room no longer has to be confined to boxes. It can be, you know, famously spheres would be similar ones. There's all kinds of different shapes that you can do. You can do multispatial. You can also, because you're dealing with what are effectively video game engines that power the images the audience is seeing, then you can incorporate video game technology into how they interact with those images. And so audiences can trigger image change, trigger this, that, and the other, or move through a story of their own devising all of a sudden, simply by following certain characters around that have a certain awareness of them too.
I don't remember which one of you was sharing that it actually started to get me emotional. If we had continued down that path, you brought me into a space where all of a sudden I felt that feeling of being connected with people that I don't get to do a lot in a theater or what have you. So you talked about something about going into a theater space and the lights are on and everybody's having their own life experience. Do you remember what we're talking about?
I do.
Share some of that.
Yeah, this is something that David and I talk about and have talked about for years. One of the things that we love about the live theater that we're beginning to bring into our immersive work. You know, for years, watching audiences walk into our theaters, knowing full well that everybody's arriving from a different place. They've had good days of work or bad days of work. They've had an argument with so-and-so or, you know, something else bad happened or something very good happened. But everybody's arriving and sitting down as the lights are up, coming from a very, very different, different place that day. And then the lights go down and the stage lights come up and the audience suddenly responds as one. They laugh as one. They gasp as one. And we've noticed as well, sometimes they'll breathe as one when the story is unfolding in front of them. And it's that kind of connection that we find magical, the ritualized storytelling magic of the theater. And then when the lights, you know, come back on and the audience goes home, something stays with them. Something lingers. There's an imprint of that show, the story, how they related to it, that we believe people carry with them. Okay, maybe it fades over time, but something stays, and we find that something to be very beautiful.
And I think that was at the heart of the work we were doing with Shakespeare's when we were performing and producing shows for all of these high school kids. They came to it with this learned helplessness about how hard Shakespeare is, that they're stupid because they don't get it. And when we could create these experiences where 1,000, 2,000 students in a theater could all walk out and suddenly emotionally understand Romeo and Juliet or Hamlet or whichever play and walk away, and they would have these moments, these epiphanies, where they would literally realize, I'm not stupid. And at the heart of it was this a belief in self-actualization that came with it, that Charles and I almost wanted to call the company the Delphi Project because of that, you know thyself. Because people would walk out of there and I mean, you were dealing with kids, many of whom had never been into a theater before and would never be in a theater again. And this, they didn't actually know how Romeo and Juliet ended, and they would gasp at the end of it. And, you know, spoiler alert. And it was amazing because they would leave with this feeling of, I can accomplish anything if I can understand this play. And we really started to recognize that that level of exploration, of understanding, of shared narrative, that was the work we were trying to figure out as we were crossing the barrier between the digital and analog worlds, trying to create what is effectively digital theater, for lack of a better word for it. We wanted something that had the ephemeral nature of theater, something that only existed while we were all together in that room on that one night, but with the ability to scale and be shared by lots of people across a lot of different environments at the same time, that you can only get with something that's digital. And what has been at the heart of the work that Charles and the tech team have been doing in the Wonder Room, and that we have been doing with a lot of the creators we're working with to tell stories, is stories that exist in a time, in a place, with the people that are there, that are unique to those set of circumstances, but can be simultaneously experienced in lots of places that aren't necessarily reliant on the number of actors that are there, that they have the ability to actually be scaled and digital and interactive in those ways. But they still have that moment of something that makes it unique that you were there on that night with those people, that it changed because of the collective nature of the experience. Mm-hmm. And that collective nature is so important to everything that we think is happening, both in what the work we're trying to do and what we see as the future of entertainment and education, as those two things really become one.
You know, you said know thyself, and then you just said how something changed because I was there. And it reminds me about Comic-Con, which I'd love for you to elaborate on in a moment. But what I thought you were going to say when we talked about Comic-Con before the show was, I thought you were going to say a large percentage of the people come in costume as if they're the character. As I was putting all this together in my mind, I was thinking, I'm possible. I'm a possible creative. Is that at all in the thinking behind the word impossible?
It's absolutely a secret little treasure in the name, of course.
Uh-huh. They were busted, Dave.
Sorry. okay, then let's talk about Comic-Con.
Well, and you know, and Mark, who's there with you, he's always a big believer in I'm possible, and he actually gave us that great quote that we use, which is the impossibilities are endless, which we love to think about that. Nice. But to get back to that Comic-Con idea, you know, there was a recent study that came out interviewing audience members that went to Comic-Cons and fan expos. And there was a shocking study where over 70% of them said that they wanted to have an influence over the stories and the outcomes of their favorite characters and franchises. And we have believed for a long time that the audiences that exist today wish to be participants, not spectators. Mm. And we're coming out of this phase where we all, you know, the attention economy and the failings of the attention economy and how it so it extracts all this value from us and our attention, and the negative impacts of that are so well documented. We think people are really starting to lean away from that. And the word that gets used a lot is the experience economy, but we've been trying to frame it around the participation economy, the participatory economy, that there's a whole type of work that's taking hold where the audience is the participant, is the, in many ways, the performer in these stories that they're sharing with people around them, that they can have influence and agency. And that might just be exploring something. It might just be being a voice who's in the audience, even going to your favorite team and supporting them has that element of participation that you somehow are the, you know, in soccer, we say the 12th man that's supporting that team. But that same idea of participating in all of these ways, whether that's entertainment, education, wellness, sport, there are so many ways that participation is influencing. And that's really what's driving both the technology we're trying to further and the way we're creating story.
Talking about Comic-Con and people dressing up, and of course what you're sharing also reminds me of like Renaissance fairs that used to be, people would go and only not, there wouldn't be a lot of people there years and years ago, and we'd watch people do things that were dressed up and all that. Well, now the whole cosplay thing, the show is the people, each other, watching each other and coming in costumes and all of that. And so more and more younger people are interested because they are part of it.
You know, that's absolutely right. And we've been watching this trend over years. About 10 years ago, we did a production of Grease, like sort of a big revival, a big Broadway scale revival in Toronto. And we noticed very early on how much of the audience was coming in costume. Women would come in the pink jackets. Men would come in their greasers, leather jackets, and slick their hair back and all that kind of stuff. And over the course of the run, we realized how much we actually had to feature the audience and get them up on stage and dancing with the cast and all of that stuff. Wow. Because they were there for that. They'd all seen the movie, they'd seen the, you know, other productions over the years, but they were there to be part of it. And yet another one of those aha moments for David and myself, when we realized, okay, this is where this whole thing is going now.
Wow. Well, thank you for thinking and for creating and pushing this forward, because it feels exciting. It just listening to you all and hearing and thinking in my head, like, what are the possibilities, makes me feel like, oh, this is even more interesting and I want to be a part of it. So, and there's that word, I want to be a part of it. I don't want to just come see it. I want to be a part of it. So what can we look forward to?
Well, the project that we're working on right now is a very, very exciting one. We're working really closely with Black Thought, the lead singer of the hip-hop band The Roots. And he's the creative director of a brand new immersive show, a walkthrough film, we're calling it, that we're, you know, well into development. And actually, he's recording some early demo songs right now, which is really exciting. And Questlove is among the producing team behind it as well. So that's slated to open at some point soon. Very exciting. And that one is his take on the origins of hip hop. And his view is other people have made documentaries of the origins of hip hop, how it came to light and all these things. His view is no, 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 no. Let's put people on the sidewalks. Let's put them on the streets when these things were happening and give them a simulation of the lived experience. Have them rub shoulders with, you know, fictional characters of those who were there. What did it feel like? That visceral transporting experience, that's where he's going to take audiences. And we couldn't be more excited to see the final result.
Very exciting. Now, I'm not asking for trade secrets here, and I know so many ideas are in development or at least formulating in your heads, but what potentially from this vantage point after all these years do you feel like the audience can walk away from an experience? Of course there'll be different kinds, but like are they better because of it? Are they, what is your hope?
That's absolutely at the heart of all of it is, you know, how can we leave an audience changed in a way that is positive, profound, allows them to think and see the world in a slightly different way? It's at the heart of all of the work we're looking at. And some of this work might be very light and entertaining. Some of it can be deeper, more thoughtful, more education-based, more, you know, there's a lot of genre work we're looking at as well, but really the goal is how do these experiences impact you in a deep, meaningful, emotional way? Because that really ties back to everything that we started on, you know, going back to that basement 25 years ago, that those audiences left changed, and that change meant they talked about it and they told their friends and people came back, and it grew and grew from there. And so we believe that kind of work where we can allow people to walk through a film and experience things in a way, explore things that have never really been possible before. You know, within a Wonder Room, you can go back to the Colosseum 2000 years ago and minutes later be on the rings of Saturn and inside a cell and anywhere else you want to go. And we want to give people the opportunity to explore things they never thought were possible and hopefully leave having had a shared collective experience, maybe understanding the people around them a bit deeper and perhaps knowing themselves a bit more.
How interesting. This is reminding me of, I didn't think I was going to share this, an exercise I did in my head over Thanksgiving. There were so many people I wanted to wish a happy Thanksgiving. You're both Canadian, so we just had Thanksgiving in America. But, and so what I did was I did this little sweep in my head of visualizing people that I love and that I knew I wouldn't be able to contact that are even here or those that are gone. And I silently hugged them all. And I'm having this visual, like in a Wonder Room that can be created with pictures of people, like almost could personal Wonder Rooms be created?
Without question. And I think that's an idea that that we've kicked around. And I think that an idea that's coming, I think it's time will actually be coming very soon now with the arrival of AI and how quickly we can generate brand new content based on very little, on short videos, on audio clips, on photos. And all of a sudden those photos can spring to life and people can be returned to a family holiday when they were children and have those kinds of very deep, deep emotional moments. But I think you're absolutely right. I think that's what this emerging art form is going to allow. It's going to allow people to reach through time and space and, in, you know, hug people they love, or maybe even, as Dave often talks about, hug themselves.
And that's a very personal thing. And yet I also could visualize where, for example, that Grease experience and whatever else you all are creating, when the group is doing this, they may want to come back, but they also, I would feel, we would also get a sense of community.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely the goal. Absolutely the goal is to have people experience these things together. And, you know, it's funny, we've talked a lot about, Charles and I over the years, about this idea of what a time machine is. And when we look at movies and books, you know, the time machine is something you step into, a DeLorean or a phone booth or whatever that might be. But we actually think that the possibilities within the Wonder Room as a physical environment or as a digital environment, it actually allows us to travel through time and space. I mean, Charles likes to say the difference between traveling somewhere and being transported somewhere. And we really have this deep ability within this storytelling environment to really take people to a place both physically and emotionally and metaphysically that they've never been before. And I think that's the really exciting promise of this world, especially when we're driving it with storytelling. You know, a lot of immersive up until now has been very much about purely the images, purely pixels on walls and inferring something out of it. But if we could actually go further and create real meaning and real story, we think the, you know, to quote Marx's phrase, the impossibilities are endless.
I feel like you're going to do it. And we started this with the power of story lies in its ability to connect people, convey values, and inspire action. And I feel like you've done it, you're doing it, and you're going to do it at a level that I don't even know who knows yet what it is. So I have, beyond all that, I have a wish for the two of you that I would like to express. I wish for the two of you and your families that someday your university will honor you with honorary doctorates for having changed story and how storytelling is told in this century.
Wow, that's wonderful, Filippo. And my mother will be proud.
I'll be proud too. I'm just delighted that we finally got to have this conversation on the show. Thank you both so much. So where do we tell people to go to learn about you? Obviously, impossiblecreative.com, right?
Impossiblecreative.co, sorry, .co.
.co, okay. And you each have respective websites that we have up on the Life Changes Show page, but anywhere else?
Those are our best bets for now, and there's going to be lots more coming very soon. So if you start at impossiblecreative.co, you will learn about not just the project we're doing with Tariq Trotter and The Roots, but a whole bunch of other exciting projects that we can't wait to announce and go public with in the very near future.
Well, we're excited. Thank you so much, David Galpern and Charles Roy. What an absolute pleasure. And I look forward to more from your camp and more on the show.
Thank you so much for having us today.
Thank you. ImpossibleCreative.co. Learn more about them there. Mark, thank you so much. You've shared over the years, and the story just keeps getting better and better and mind-blowing, actually, in some ways.
I think the future is caught up to us. Mm-hmm. And these are ideas whose time has come, but it's interesting because the amount of experience is intangible in terms of the feedback that you get from audiences, the tests that are done, the staging of shows in different towns with different demographics, with different cultures. You know, when you look at the expanse of the experience and the expanse of the production history, you really start to understand what informs the, you know, the way that they see the world now, and more importantly, how to support them revisioning things.
You know, we really didn't get to get into the technology, but we got the idea, and I think the technology is probably going to change anyway.
Well, that's the way Impossible Creative is oriented. It's future proofing because there's so much happening. So, you know, the innovations in the Wonder Room and the approach and the software extensions that have been built in order to be able to achieve multispatial is there and is game changing, but is also set up to be able to ingest new innovations. AI is changing things by the second. We don't know what is going to come at us in the way of immersivity and interactivity and new tools. So being ready to storytell agnostically in any space and an environment and be able to onboard all new technologies is the idea.
You know, Mark, to a point that you talk about, when I mentioned, I didn't expect to mention it, but when I talked about that little exercise I did at Thanksgiving with visualizing people and hugging them individually, now that's something I could probably do with a headset, but to be in there potentially with my community or my family or my friends, and we all get to have that experience together, hugging each other while we're doing this or whatever. Now that just blew my mind.
Well, it's kind of like advocating for humans. You know, we are here to have an experience, to relate, to connect with our friends and family, even though much of technology has been designed to divide us and isolate us and disconnect us. So we look at headsets as a great extension to the physical if you can't be there physically. But ideally, the experience is designed for the physical. And then when you take those 360 experiences and put them into other 360 spaces, they feel like they're in the original space, just like we've talked about domes and other environments as well.
Yeah. Wow. What a great conversation. I can't wait till more. ImpossibleCreative.co. A big thank you again to David Galpern and Charles Roy. And now it's time for our Ask Dorothy segment.
Dear Dorothy, this is John, and I am grateful for the guidance you have given me over the years. You are the only person I know who is genuinely happy and inspired no matter the challenges that you face. My problem is that my boss doesn't treat me well in the way he talks to me, and I'm not sure I can continue to work for him. How can I become happy and inspired no matter the challenges I face every workday?
Dear John, I am honored that you've trusted me over the years, and I'm really glad you reached out for answers to this important question. I have met your boss, and he has told me that he genuinely likes you and appreciates you and is glad you work with him. So let's find a way that helps you feel stronger, more centered, and far less affected by his behavior. What I finally discovered and put into practice is that it is possible to feel happy, inspired, and grounded, even when someone around you behaves poorly. But it doesn't happen through willpower. It happens by choosing where your power comes from. Right now, you are allowing your boss's treatment to determine your emotions. However, his behavior and your well-being do not need to be linked. Your boss's treatment isn't about your worth, your competency, or your spirit. It's about his filters, stresses, insecurities, habits, and blind spots. When you stop taking his behavior personally, the emotional impact drops dramatically. It will be good when you choose to shift from reaction to observation when your boss behaves badly. Instead of, why is he doing this to me? You can shift to, oh, this is where he is emotionally today. This shift lets you stay centered, calm, and powerful. And let's remember that your happiness comes not from your boss's mood. It comes from living your values, honoring yourself, growing spiritually, doing your work with integrity, and treating yourself gently. And now, let's look at my formula for happiness. As I've said before, what we focus on expands. So let's focus on what you believe about yourself, how you speak to yourself, and where you place your emotional boundaries. You can become unshakable, not by avoiding challenges, but by becoming someone who isn't defined by them. And, dear John, you have the ability to do this. You've grown spiritually, emotionally, and energetically for years. This is just the next step. When you do make this choice, you will find yourself to be happier and inspired to make more elegant choices. I look forward to hearing of your progress as you choose to step into your power and make the great choice of observation over reaction.
Thank you, Dorothy. And if you have a question for Dorothy, be like John and write her at AskDorothy@LifeChangesShow.com.
And for our performance segment, we are featuring a New Orleans-based artist, musician, and composer, Evan Oberla. Welcome, Evan, to the Life Changes Show.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
It's so great to have you, especially for this show. We'll talk about it more a little later, how the episode is perfect for the conversation we're going to have. But before we get into that, I have to ask you, you moved to New Orleans. I thought you were born there, but you weren't. So tell us why.
Well, yeah, I wasn't born here, but I was drawn here, and it is my home now, for sure. I came from Ohio, the Northlands of Ohio.
The Northlands, okay.
And, you know, it was nice, and I had a great education, music education. There's a lot of great musicians up there, and I learned a lot, and I was just embraced. And the great thing about where I grew up is that there's just like space to be you, in terms of, you know, you're not trying to, it wasn't super expensive compared to the coast growing up, you know. So there was space to be like, well, who are you, you know. But at certain point there, I had to move, and I had come down to New Orleans several times and played music down here, and then I just, like, my heart just called. I was like, I'm home when I was there.
Wow. So,
yeah, it's a place that is just it really asks you, who are you and how are you going to show up today to truly fit in the flow of the world, you know. And New Orleans will kick you out if you're trying to be fake with it.
Now, when somebody thinks New Orleans, or when I do at least, we talked about a couple of people that I think of and that you've actually worked with. And also we think trombone. What do you play?
I play trombone, and that's also a big part of it. It's sort of trombone mecca down here. And it's incredible to be in a place where you can walk down the street and so many killing horn players are just, you can hear them, or you can call them up, or you'll see them out and you sit in, and it's just like, what's better than one trombone, two trombones, and et cetera. Yeah.
So it's interesting, right off the bat, you're kind of sharing, like, there are different sides to you, and you're having different experiences. And with your music, we're going to actually hear that. With your music, there's the one side of you that does this and the other side of you that does that. How do you define that before we hear a song?
Well, part of it comes from, coming from an instrumentalist space where you're hyper aware of everything going on. And then there's another part where there's the singer, there's the vocalist, there's a story that you have to get out that only you can really truly tell. And I've felt that call from a young age, and I've also just, you know, been able to hear music in my head, and I try to get it out as best as I can. So I think, how do I meld these two areas of myself into one singular experience? And that's something I've had to grapple with, and it's kind of been an allegory of in actual life too, just understanding, okay, what am I here to do? You know, there's so many avenues, especially as a musician, you could go down. And I think that's something that when you grow up, you're like, oh, you're a musician. Oh, you here's this platform that, this is what making it is. And then, oh no, this is what making it is. And really is, it's what do you make of it, and what is it to you? So I've just kind of started following my path and trying to be authentic in what I have to say. But also, I'm always growing and wanting to learn more. And that's a thing. I'm never going to stay stagnant. So it's always an evolution.
Well, I love how your album, one that came out a couple of years ago, is titled Art for the number four, All. Mm-hmm. Art for All. Okay, yes. Good. Thank you. And we'll take it. And so we're going to get to hear Pineapple Juice. Actually, it's on the album, but we're going to get to hear an unplugged version, you and guitar, right?
Yes.
Anything we need to know about the song before...
This song, I wrote it, I was with my now wife, and we were in the pandemic, it was pre-pandemic, but we were in the kitchen or the apartment somewhere, and just singing songs, and there's a pineapple hat, and hence Pineapple Juice was born out of that. And it's kind of speaking to the point of Art for All, which is like, what is that thing within you that when you open it up, it's just like pours out and you just feel open and comfortable and juicy and, you know, something to share and fresh and exciting. And I believe everyone has that within them, and it's their own unique path. So it's a journey of finding that and opening that in a way that feels true to you. And I think that nice. If we all leaned into that, it could be a little bit more spacious place in the world.
Well, we're going to get some of your pineapple juice right now. Here's right. Evan Oberla here on the Life Changes Show with his original song, live.
Live.
Pineapple juice.
All right.
Ooh, I can't get enough of that juicy stuff. Ooh, I can't get enough. Just the taste will lift me up, yeah. Sturdy exterior, juicy on the inside, won't you let me inside? Sturdy exterior, juicy on the inside, won't you welcome me inside? You keep me loose, loose, loose. You keep me loose, loose, loose. You keep me loose, loose, loose. You keep me loose, loose, alone. Ooh, when you walk on by, I can't help but smile as wide as a country mile. Ooh, when you slide on through, there's nowhere I'd rather be than right here with you now. Sturdy exterior, juicy on the inside, won't you let me inside? Sturdy exterior, juicy on the inside, won't you welcome me inside? You keep me loose, loose, loose. You keep me loose, loose, loose. You keep me loose, loose, loose. You keep me loose, loose. Oh, I'm talking about pineapple juice. You make me happy, that pineapple juice. There ain't another like you, pineapple juice. You make me happy, that pineapple juice. There ain't another like you. There ain't another like you, yeah. Oh, zum dum da dum dum, sa da da dum da da dum 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 dum, sa da 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 da, sa da 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 da. Like you, pineapple juice.
Fun. Pineapple juice. Where's yes. a good place for people to follow you, Evan?
You can find me on my website, evanoberla.com, or on Bandcamp and all the socials.
Indeed, and we have lots of links at the Life Changers show page for Evan Oberla, O-B-E-R-L-A.
Yeah, O-B-E-R-L-A. It's taken me some time with that because it's an interesting name. It has vowels on both sides. So you got to slow it down and give it a little space. Oberla, you know.
Oberla.
And so that's also something I'm trying to really focus on, is just growing space. And that Art for All record and this new one I'm recording, it's centered around the grow concept, which is the band is the grow. And it's just to grow space and find expansion in the small moments.
Nice. Well, yeah. Speaking of expansion and growing, and what we've been talking about throughout this whole show with Impossible Creative and starting out with art and taking...
Honestly, that was just like really amazing listening to them talk about that. And I really want to see it.
Right?
But I feel the kismet, the synergy between the two concepts that we're talking about.
Yes. So let's go ahead and talk about it. It's Canal Street Revolution. Tell us. Mm-hmm.
All right. So Canal Street, I was living downtown in 2019, and the Hard Rock Hotel they were building at the edge of the French Quarter collapsed. And I don't think it got really any national attention, but people died and it was a tragedy. And but it swept under the rug. Honestly, I had to play a second line for a bachelorette party that day in the quarter, and I saw it, you know. And but the party had to continue, you know. And so just it had me thinking, it had me just like something's got to give here. And fast forward a year, and I was looking at grant opportunities, and I got one from the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation. And my mind went there, and I realized, and I researched, and I found out it was the space of the Woolworths back in the 1960s, which was the site of the first sit-in in the civil rights movement with Aretha, Castle Haley, and the Core Four. So extrapolating that, I started researching, and post the sit-ins, there were the protests on Canal Street for 35 stores to desegregate. And it wasn't even a law, it was just custom. And so I talked to the people that were actually there and protested, and they're still here. So I interviewed these elders and culture bearers, and I got the lowdown on the whole thing, and I recorded it. And then I took these clips and I wrote music based on these interviews. Wow. And you know, I thought it was gonna be just like pretty straightforward, but I mean, it was also the pandemic, peak pandemic, so there was a lot of time to think about all this stuff, and you know, it was a transformation period for myself, and this music allowed me a space to do so and really like dive into these stories that were told to me, and how do I then tell a story based on all this with the music and everything. And then I brought in a bunch of horn players and rhythm sections from New Orleans, just a bunch of cats that were just like I've have history with, and just in a New Orleans studio. And we laid down 13 tracks, and that became the record Canal Street Revolution. And it's interesting because it's not just, it's sort of like that revolution will not be televised, and the fact that it's a revolution within yourself, and exploring biases and prejudices and just beliefs, and wondering like, how did these get here? And having an honest look at yourself so you can actually move forward and get out of your own way. And that way, all the divisive rhetoric that is crammed down our throats when we loop in a screen or anything, or look outside in certain cases, you know, that won't have the effect of dividing us, because no matter what, I see you as my neighbor, I see you as my brother, I see you as my sister, you know. And that we, the stories that we get to hear from each other and share with each other, become this framework for a new society that doesn't have to what it does do is it brings us together and opens us the space, and that abundance of a human experience, which you guys were talking about earlier, and in a way that there was an AI component, but this is just truly just in the lineage of the history, and just knowing our history and where we come from is so huge, and they're trying to erase that. So this is a little piece to just remember, like, hey, this happened, and this isn't the first time we're going through this, so we can pull on experiences. Like there's one part where Dr. Rafael Casimir, who was the youth council president of the NAACP, was talking about, he went to his advisor, he's like, we're going, and it took 747 days of constant, continuous protest to make this happen. And they, wow. His advisor advised him, like, you know, this is incremental, every step we're opening it up a little bit more, and every step. So that's something I try to bring to where I'm at in my life, and not to get ahead of it, have the vision, but step by step, you know, in an actionable way.
Amazing. Evan, before we hear the song, and this will be the pre-recorded version, just real quickly, I know the album has gotten good reviews, but what have you heard from the people who actually shared the stories with you, and what have been some of their comments?
Oh, they dig it. I've got nothing but good feedback. And then honestly, one of the speakers I've been working with, Abe Thompson, and working with his music. And so it's just become a friendship. And, you know, just getting encouragement from these cats, and just it, we're seeing each other, you know, and it's really beautiful.
Wow. Wow. Well, here it is. So this is the title track, and it's Canal Street or Canal Street Revolution?
Canal Street Revolution is the title track and the album.
Okay. Very good. Well, here it is, Evan Oberla. and his pre-recorded song that's just like it is on the album here on the Life Changes Show.
Canal Street was part of the grounding I had in understanding that no struggle is straight.
Street.
Wow. And there it is. Evan, thank you so much for sharing that with us. How perfect.
Thank you.
Canal Street Revolution. That's the album. That's the song you just heard as well. What an absolute pleasure. Again, Evan Oberla, O-H-B-E-R-L-A.
O-B-E-R-L-A, yep. Thank you so much for having me.
Such a pleasure. And we got to thank Colin Martin for introducing us to you. So thank you to Colin.
Day one, homie.
All know and love very much. So another great musician. All the best to you and your project. Want to hear more good news coming from that and more music as well. Absolutely. So thank you, Evan.
Thank you, Philip. Appreciate it.
Oh, I've been saying O-H. I'm sorry. It's Oberla.
Without the Ohio is getting in the way again. Just got to let that go.
Oberla. O-B-E-R-L-A. You were trying to say that, and I'm like, okay. So
it's
Evan Oberla, thank you so much. All the best to you.
All right, same to you, for sure.
And with a big thank you to Evan Oberla, O-B-E-R-L-A, and then to David Galpern and Charles Roy. That is our show. On behalf of our executive producer, Dorothy Lee Donahue, and our executive producer and co-host, Mark Lejeune, and our whole family here at the Life Changes Show, I am your host, Filippo Voltaggio, reminding you that as your life changes, like ours surely did tonight, we're here for you. Ciao, everyone.
You have been listening to the Life Changes Show on the BBS Radio Network. Listen live every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time and visit us online at lifechangesnetwork.com, on Facebook at The Life Changes Show, and on Twitter at Life Changes Show. Join us again next week as we consciously explore and embrace the only constant, life changes. The Life Changes Network is an entertainment network. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and participants and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Life Changes.